all tonight. We feel that the Westboro Library is greatly honored because we have a man with us tonight who cares a tremendous amount about one of our founding fathers, and he has done a tremendous amount of research, and he has interest and spent many long years now. He's a history professor at Holy Cross, and he and I have worked together through the years to acquire some of the things that are at the American Antiquarian Society so that the copies would be here in Westboro in the local history room so that we would have them as well as the American Antiquarian. We only have the copies. The American Antiquarian has the originals where they should be because they have the facilities to take care of these things. But tonight I want to introduce to you Professor Ross Beals, and he's going to tell you about the family life of Ebenezer Parkman, one of our real heritage men. Professor Beals.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I'm somewhat nervous about being here, however. I think other than about three or four other people, I'm the individual who knows most about Ebenezer Parkman's diary. I've spent more time, I think, than any of you would think would be sane reading that document and transcribing good portions of it. The only other people with whom I'm, of whom I know anything who are more familiar with the document would be, of course, Ebenezer Parkman himself, Clifford K. Shipton, who used the document in writing many of the sketches for Sibley's Harvard graduates, Francis Ouellette, formerly at Worcester State College, who edited the first sections of the diary, which the Antiquarian Society published first in its proceedings and then later published in a single volume, and then also Fran Van Loo, who helped Mr. Ouellette do much of the research for his annotations of that diary. So I feel very secure in knowing a great deal about Ebenezer Parkman's world, narrowly defined by the incredible number of pages which he devoted to his diary. What makes me nervous, however, is the fact that I have to confess that I've been in Westboro certainly not more than half a dozen times in my life. I have no family connections here. I have no sense of the town's geography, no sense of families other than Parkman and the persons with whom he came into contact. So I'm sure that some of you have been here all of your lives and perhaps can trace your ancestry back to the days of Ebenezer Parkman. I'm sure you have a much better sense of place than I possibly could have or will develop. So that if I make mistakes, I hope you will call them to my attention. If I say things that are perfectly clear to me but not to you, I hope that you'll jot them down and raise them during the question and answer period. I want to start by mentioning something that occurred a couple of weeks ago. About two summers ago, I spent a great deal of time transcribing significant portions of the Westboro church records, which are really a collection of very, very interesting documents. I transcribed them onto a word processing machine and then ran a copy off, which I loaned to a student about 2 weeks ago. She read through the Westboro church records, and I asked her, well, what did you think of them? And her first response was that there wasn't really much about the American Revolution in them. And of course, Parkman's church records start back in the 1720s, and the volume goes beyond his death in 1782, but all I had transcribed was the period up through 1782. And you know, she remarked, there's really not much in there about the Revolution. Now that really, I think, reflected in part her own perspective as a novice historian, someone who didn't take into account the fact that a document or a record is kept for a certain purpose and not for others. And so one can read volumes upon volumes of church records and find little other than baptisms and admission to communion or the admissions to halfway status, disciplinary cases, and the like. So to a degree, she hadn't really asked questions about why the document was created and therefore why not much was said about the Revolution in the document. There's another question there too, however, and that relates to how one attaches importance to documents generated by people living, say, 200 years ago, who had no particular importance. Certainly, Ebenezer Parkman was important in his life, to his family, to his parishioners, to the town, to men and women with whom he came into contact throughout his long life. But it would be very difficult to make a case that Parkman himself was important in the traditional ways that historians talk about an individual's importance. Indeed, and I say this coming from the town of Holden, which really racks up in terms of historical significance, no more importance, and I think a good deal less, than the town of Westboro. We can't look to any famous patriot. We can't find an Eli Whitney, even born in Holden, whereas you can find one, of course, born in Westboro. So that the ways that traditional historians or the historians look traditionally at history really don't address themselves to why one should look at local records, why one should look at the life of an obscure country parson. After all, we won't learn a great deal about why the Americans won the Revolution. We won't learn a great deal about the Great Awakening. We won't learn a great deal about the intellectual life of colonial New England. We will, however, I think, learn a great deal about many other questions that I find interesting and I also find important. We learn a great deal about the fabric of everyday life, about the exchange of goods and articles among individuals, about education at the local level, about the religious experiences of rather obscure people. I had thought perhaps of titling the talk this evening, Westboro from the Bottom Up, meaning that traditionally historians look at history from the top down, from those figures who make, if you will, significant waves on the pages of history as traditionally written. Ebenezer Parkman and his parishioners didn't make big waves, at least they thought they were big occasionally, but as we write history and as we read it in textbooks, not very many big waves. However, Parkman left a document in his diary. He left papers also, the church records and records related to those church records. He left an account book. Two of his children left manuscript diaries. One of his daughters left a diary which is no longer extant, as far as I know, in its manuscript form, but appears in the 100th town. There's an unusually rich and what a sociologist or anthropologist might call a thick collection of documentation for 18th century Westboro, which means that probably far more than any other community in New England for the period from the 1720s down to the 1780s, we have incredibly rich documentation, thanks in large part to Ebenezer Parkman. We know that other people kept diaries, some of which survive, but few people kept diaries of such extent that also happened to survive, along with this wonderful clustering of records. Now, we could talk almost endlessly, and as my research goes on Westboro, I think it's almost endless. We could talk endlessly about a huge range of topics. What I want to look at particularly this evening is Parkman's family life, and especially to focus upon his relationships with his children. I'm going to say a few things to begin with that I'm sure all of you, or at least most of you, know, but for those of you who may not know much about Parkman, let me, in the formal part of my paper, say some things to remind you about his place and time. As I mentioned, he was a respected individual, certainly revered by his parishioners, or at least most of them. Clearly he had fights with some of them. A man who was successful on a small scale, that is, he was a Harvard graduate, a man who, by his social origins, we could say was upwardly mobile, that is, his father was a Boston shipwright who was able to send his son off to Harvard College. He was a man who, by the standards of the day, did make some impression, at least in terms of printed matter, that is, he was able to publish three of his sermons during his lifetime, although the attribution of one of them to Parkman is not a firm attribution. He was invited in the early 1760s to preach one of the sermons before the Boston Ministerial Convention, which was a mark of his colleagues' respect and esteem for him. He served on numerous ecclesiastical councils called to iron out, to sort out differences among parishioners or between parishioners and their ministers. He kept quite adequate records of the Westboro Church and of the Marlborough Association, of which he was a member and longtime scribe. But beyond that, as I suggest, he does not make particular public notice. Rather, it's that diary that makes him so, so very important. He started the diary back when he was a Harvard College student, perhaps as early as 1719. And he kept it with a kind of perseverance, a kind of regularity that astounds us, I think, today. Very rarely missing a day's entry, and sometimes writing quite extensively about things that happened to occur to him. And he kept that diary from 1719 down to about a week or two before his death in December of 1782, making it one of the longest diaries that we know of from the colonial period, and in terms of the surviving portions, certainly one of the most important. That is, if you sort out all the gaps in it, you have 40 or 45 years of the diary still extant. He was sick in the 1750s for a time. I think he must have feared that he was going to die. He looked back on the early diaries, the ones that I wish he had not destroyed, the ones from his Harvard years, and he tossed them into the fireplace. His diaries for the 1730s, when his first wife died, don't survive, and there are other gaps in the diary. But every internal evidence from the diary suggests that this was not an episodically kept document, but rather something that was regularly kept. Now, I think one way to get at the diary and what it means to us is to ask, not to have you raise your hands, but how many of you have written in your diary today? And probably not many of you. And how many of you have written anything, diary, letter, memorandum, whatever it might be, that indicates what you think about nuclear disarmament or what you think about the impending presidential election? And probably, even though you're going to go out and vote, and even though the prospect of nuclear war probably worries you, you haven't written much of it down. And so the same thing, to come back to that student's comment about the Westboro Church records, and indeed about Ebenezer Parkman's diary, comes to mind. He wasn't giving a great deal of thought to things such as the American Revolution, even though he records news of battles, he records the fact that he reads the Vermont State Constitution, that he reads Tom Paine's Common Sense, and so on. But he doesn't spend a great deal of time with those kinds of things. Rather, his diary tends to be a record of things that took place in Westboro and of which he wanted to keep a record. Predictably, for example, the Sunday sermons and the texts on which he preached, visits that he made to his parishioners, because he thought, in one sense or another, he wanted to keep kind of account book of whom he had visited and whom, therefore, he thought had been adequately cared for. He kept a record of people who visited him and the number of meals which, quote unquote, he served. Obviously, it was not he who served them, but rather either of the two Mrs. Parkmans. And so day by day, he kept this record, relentlessly recording the weather, the crops, troubles with servants, disputes among his parishioners, efforts to convert or to console, efforts to minister to the various needs of both his family and his parishioners. What, as I said, I want to focus on is Parkman's relationships with his family, and particularly his children. Now, I've handed out to you a couple of pages of documents which record the basic facts of Parkman's life. Several things are worth noting on that first sheet. First of all, Parkman married not unusually young, but basically at a time when he could afford to. That is, after he had completed his education and was secure in the prospects for his career. He was about 20 years old. The woman he married, Mary Champney of Cambridge, was about 4 years his senior. They were married for a little more than a decade. They had a number of children, and we don't know what carried Mary Champney Parkman off, but she died in the mid-1730s. Parkman, like all husbands who had lost a spouse, was faced with a particular dilemma. That is, how do you care for a, by our standards, a rather large family at the time of his first wife's death? And he, unlike his contemporaries, was stuck with the problem of who is a suitable wife for a minister. And when a minister goes courting, I don't know whether it happens in the 20th century, but when a minister goes courting in the 18th or the 17th century, he has certain kinds of expectations which drastically narrow down the potential spouses for his remarriage. What he ended up doing was to marry Hannah Breck, the daughter of the former, now deceased, Marlborough minister, a woman who was considerably younger than he. And one could make the case that sociological circumstances force him to find a minister's daughter, just as several of his own daughters marry ministers. And the accident, of course, was that he married somebody who was quite young and therefore would bear him many, many more children. And so you look at that list of children, and even though Hannah Breck Parkman had two miscarriages, she was certainly able to bear him a good number of children, meaning that on a minister's salary, Parkman faced an excruciating dilemma. Because not only was he fortunate in being able to remarry, and fortunate to a degree in having a large family, but he was also fortunate, from one perspective, in that most of his children survived to adulthood. Unlike many families in the 1730s and 1740s who were affected by the so-called throat distemper, that is, an epidemic of diphtheria, which literally decimated whole communities and families, Parkman's family seemed to have been relatively healthy. Meaning, of course, that on that minister's salary, he had to provide for a good number of sons and daughters as well. Well, a word also not only about the size of his family, but also about the nature of a household in the 18th century. I think this is important from two respects. First of all, we tend to think of the household unit as a relatively static entity. Mother, father, children, and so on. We don't tend to look at it as a dynamic entity, that is, something that whose needs change over time and whose composition changes over time. So that one rule of thumb that we can make for Parkman is that his household size fluctuates dramatically over the years of his married life, over the years of his two marriages. And in the 1750s, when Parkman's first children, Mary, his first daughter, Ebenezer Jr., his first son, are just beginning to court, to establish relationships, to be married, to set up separate households, at that time in the 1750s, he's still a father and still becoming a father. And he becomes a father down to the age, to 1761, that is, until the age of 58. Now, this suggests a number of things. First of all, unlike families today, the Parkmans were forever, or almost forever, surrounded by dependent children. That is, when Parkman died in 1782, he still had one child at home dependent on him and his wife, and he had barely given up all of the rest of the children. So parenting, being a member of a household in which there were young and dependent children was something which he never escaped. His golden years, insofar as they were golden, were never golden because of the absence of familial responsibilities. A second thing that's worth, I think, noting about this household is that the household itself, while it grows and then declines in size because of the birth of children, then their eventual marriage, and then finally the almost complete disappearance of children from the household also has other components to it. Almost without exception, hardly a month goes by when Parkman is not seeking or actually having in the household at least two kinds of workers. That is, a female servant who will help Mrs. Parkman with what Parkman calls the slavish work, and one can imagine all of the kinds of things that composed that slavish work. I think of just the chores of emptying chamber pots and cleaning chamber pots, the slavish work of doing all of the really grungy work that that no longer is our burden today because of the kinds of appliances and luxuries that we in the 20th century possess. The Parkmans also, or Ebenezer, also tried usually to have some kind of a male laborer around the house. That is, usually this would be a laborer who would be there typically or most needed from the early spring down through October, sometimes staying the year round. Again, a person who could do some of the brute work of farming, the carrying out of the muck, that is, the taking of the manure from the barns in the spring out onto the fields, the brute work of harvesting during the late summer and early autumn. Might add a parenthetical note about that. One of the nice things about working with a New England town is that many of the New England towns, many of the Massachusetts towns, including Westboro, saw fit under state encouragement to publish their vital records back around the turn of the century. Now, one product of this is our ability to go back and find out certain things about some of the most intimate aspects of human behavior that we can on a statistical basis. And so if one wants to find out whether there's a pattern to the births of children across the year, one can go back and find the birth of a first child to a marriage. One can also go back and find the births throughout the year. And you'll find, if you subtract roughly 9 months from the birth date, that there's a real cyclical pattern to the procreation of children. That is, very few children are conceived, relatively speaking, in the summer months. And clearly, from a diary like Parkman's, you can see why. The days are extraordinarily long. The work burden is extraordinarily hard, intense, and crucial, of course, to livelihood. So that sexual behavior follows a kind of cyclical pattern. And one can see this in the work patterns seen in Parkman's diary and in the statistics that one can derive from the vital records. So Parkman is likely to have servants of both a domestic and a farm variety throughout the year. He has them throughout the course of his married life as well. In other words, it's not because, say, Ebenezer Jr. or Thomas or Billy is able to somehow help out with the farm work that would free him up from employment of a non-relative. Rather, he uses those farm laborers as a way of trying desperately sometimes to give his sons some breathing room, to hopefully encourage them to learn their Latin so that maybe one of them or two of them or three of them will go off to Harvard College. The household also fluctuates in another respect. That is, throughout the course of his married life, children come and go. That is, some of them go off and live with other siblings. For example, when the oldest children set up separate households, a common source of labor for those newly created households is the younger children, their younger brothers and sisters, and so they get exported to the new households. Children go off to school, particularly the boys. Ebenezer Jr., for example, spending some time at Boston Latin School. Children also go off, in the case of the males, as apprentices. In some rather unhappy circumstances from Parkman's perspectives. Parkman also takes into his household a number of non-relatives who are not there to work. That is, he takes in boarders of one kind or another, people who have a need and who can fit into the household in some cases by providing cash, in some cases by providing services. For example, he takes into his household a number of young men whom he tutors for both college preparation and then later young men whom he tutors in the skills of preaching and reading the Bible, studying the scriptures, preparing sermons. And these semi-boarders, if you'll call them, also return services for him, doing some chores which make his life easier, which make his household run more smoothly. He also takes in relatives of a variety of kind. Lydia Champney is a woman whom you see frequently in the diary. She is Mary Champney Parkman's sister, who never marries, and who seems, and it's difficult to track this down, seems throughout her life to go from household to household, always living with other relatives, always having, I think, probably a relatively insecure status, always dependent on members of her family who will take her in and for whom she will provide certain kinds of services. Although Parkman, as a male, never talks about those services, one can imagine her doing what today we would call babysitting, child care, cooking, mending, sewing, and the like. Now, dealing with the diary, there's a real drawback. It's written, of course, by a man, and it's written by a man in an era when gender segregation was very rigid. That is, male and female spheres were quite distinct, and the amount of information that Parkman is likely to include about his wife, whom he invariably, both of them, refers to as Mrs. Parkman. Occasionally, I think he lowers himself to talk about his wife by a first name. But the Mrs. Parkman that you see in the diary suggests some of the perhaps distance between that male and the female sphere. So that much of what we know about the Parkman children is really what we know about the Parkman boys, because it's to whom he devotes most of his attention, about whom he has most concern, and for whom he strives in his sometimes bumbling way to do his best. Well, what I'm going to do, rather than speaking ab lib as I've done to this point, is to speak rather more systematically from the paper that I've prepared, and to talk specifically about some of the stages of life in the Parkman household. What I want to do is to take the children from the time of their conception down to the time of their marriages. A lot could be said, of course, about the relationship between a family and its members after the children leave the household, after they set up separate households, after they have children of their own and the grandchildren, as in the case of the Parkman family, come back into the grandparents' home. A lot could be said about those things, but I don't think I have the time, and frankly, at this point, I haven't gotten that far into the manuscript portions of the Parkman diary to treat these things systematically. Well, one thing about the Parkman family that I think is worth noting is that despite the fact that the Parkman women are enormously prolific in terms of the children that they bear, Parkman says, as a diarist, very little about his wife's pregnancies. That is, if they are uncomfortable, he's likely to note it. But insofar as he and his wives talked about, or thought about, hoped about, the outcome of a pregnancy, it's not there. Perhaps it was just too mundane to talk about, perhaps it was just too intimate to talk about. So that when his wives are pregnant, we learn only about the two miscarriages, for example, that Hannah Breck Parkman has, or we learn about the onset of labor pains, typically in an 18th or in a 17th century diary. The diarist will refer to his wife becoming ill at the onset of labor. So we don't know whether they talked about their unborn children, although we may expect that they, in fact, did. And of course, Parkman, as a minister, would have every reason to talk about, or at least to pray about, those unborn children, because from his perspective as a man of the cloth and as a Puritan steeped in Puritan theology, he knew that from the moment of a child's conception, that that child had a soul, and that that soul was a valuable entity in itself, regardless of whether the child was stillborn or successfully born. Well, we know a little bit about the circumstances surrounding the birth of the Parkman children because for those portions of the diary that are extant, Parkman regularly notes the onset of labor pains. He regularly notes the panic that seems to go throughout the household as people scatter across the community to seek out, in the early years, a midwife, or in the later years, to seek out a doctor, the assembling of the women who come to assist the midwife or the doctor, the joyous news of the birth of a child, and so on. But that's all seen by the outsider, by the man who is never allowed into that inner sanctum where the actual birth takes place. Parkman's first connection with his children would be, of course, on the day of their birth, but more importantly, probably from his perspective as a minister, would be that first formal introduction of the child into the Westboro community. That is, the baptism of the child, which, as you know, would typically take place on the first Sunday after the birth of the child. Now, in Parkman's family, and I suspect in most families as well, the wife who had just given birth to a child would be confined to the household for a period of perhaps 5 or 6 weeks. That is, the woman would first be confined merely to her room, then perhaps to the house without doing any work around the house. Then Parkman would note the point at which she began to do kitchen work. And then finally, invariably, he would note the day when she would first come forth publicly to attend church. Now, that would usually be 5 or 6 weeks down the road from the birth of the child. And in the meantime, of course, the emphasis was on the baptism of the child as soon as was appropriate or possible, usually on that first Sunday after the child's birth. Now, Parkman, of course, as minister and father, has a kind of dilemma there. He can't hold his own child and baptize it at the same time. So typically, someone like his own father in one instance, a midwife in another instance, his daughter in still yet another instance, would hold the child while the child was baptized and brought into the covenant of the church. This is a familiar kind of ceremony, something which, of course, many, many children experienced. More interesting, I think, from the perspective of what we can glean from Parkman's diary, is the choice of names which Parkman and his wives gave to those children. That's on that second table, the second page of the handout which I've given you. Parkman's choice of names is, in one sense, very, very typical of the 17th and 18th century, and in another sense, most untypical. It's very typical in the fact that his wife's name, Mary, or Molly, as she was called, went to the firstborn daughter, and his own name went to the firstborn son. If you go back through vital records, if you go back to genealogies, as I'm sure many of you have done, that's it's not an absolute or universal pattern, but it's such a pervasive pattern as to be almost one of the rules of child naming in the 17th and 18th century. Whereas today, of course, it's relatively unusual for a woman to give her name to a daughter. In another respect, however, the Parkmans seem to have violated a rule that was quite pervasive in the 17th and 18th centuries, and that is the rule that children could be replaced, at least nominally, after their death by naming a subsequent sibling with their own name. And one can see this in countless vital records and countless genealogies, where a male or female child dies, and then the next same-sex sibling, that is, the next boy, if it was a male who died, the next girl, if it was a female who died, being named by that same name. Now, the Parkmans avoid that practice. They don't carry through on it. I'm not sure why. They had plenty of opportunity to do it. They could have named a girl, they could have reused one girl's name, I think, a total of 5 times. They had so many opportunities to do it. Yet they avoided it. I don't know why. Perhaps one reason is that they had plenty of other choices for names. That is, if you look down that list as to how they chose the names, there are plenty of living and dead kin after whom the child can be named. But you never talk about why you, or at least I don't think you talk about why you didn't use a name. Rather, you talk about why you do, in fact, use a name. Now, another thing which departments do, which I think is somewhat atypical, at least of ministers, if you go back to the 17th century and read ministers' diaries or the diaries of pious members of any community, frequently the choice of the name will be biblically inspired. The family will choose a name because they expect, following good Puritan doctrine, that when the child hears his or her name called, it will be not just the name by which you differentiate among seven or eight children, but rather it will be a name which reminds the child of a biblical role model. And so the idea is select a name because what you want to do is have the child model itself after a figure in the, usually the Old Testament, although sometimes, of course, the New Testament as well. The Parkmans do this only implicitly. That is, there are biblical names which they choose. But never when he names or baptizes a child does Parkman say that he chooses a name because of a biblical figure. Almost invariably, when he discusses the choice of a name, it's because he wants to honor a particular individual, a father, a mother, a cousin, an aunt, someone who has died perhaps a generation or two earlier. So in one respect, Parkman is typical, that is the naming of the boy and the girl after the father and the mother. In one respect, he is not typical at all because they do not reuse names. And in still third respect, he may or may not be typical because if the biblical inspiration was there, he as a minister does not record it. Sociologists are particularly interested in the use of names because frequently they hypothesize that a name has a certain exchange value. That is, you don't select a name because it's the name of the black sheep in the family. Rather, you select a name because it's somebody you want to honor, or perhaps somebody after whom you want the child to model itself, or because perhaps the person so honored by having his or her name given to a child will return some benefit, be in some way a benefactor, provide special counsel, provide an apprenticeship, provide funds for a college education or whatever. Parkman may have had that in mind, but he never explicitly stated it, nor did he ever try to use the name or the namesake in any negotiations with a relative. There was one occasion, a very interesting occasion, when he's clearly concerned that one of his brothers has not remembered a son named after the brother. He goes into Boston, the brother and he meet throughout a day or two of conversations and dealings about the settlement of his mother's estate. There's not a mention of the son. And Parkman writes, my brother did not mention, and I've forgotten which son it was, and Parkman is upset about this. And then he says, well, I think I know the reason. It was because my brother was so concerned about my mother's estate. And then he says, I will not note it. Of course, that's what he's just done. He's just noted the fact. I mean, he was burning at that. Now, once Parkman has seen his children through, or witnessed secondhand, I think, the birth of the children and seen to their naming and baptism, the children really don't appear much for the next 4 or 5 years. And you can go down the lists of things that we might be concerned about. We're concerned about the weight of our children, and of course we take them regularly to doctors and have them weighed, and some people have scales at home and you want to just see how the child is progressing. Parkman, as far as I can tell, weighs one child once. Now, he probably weighed all of his children, I have no idea, or his wives weighed the children, don't know. But it's only significant on one occasion, and Parkman doesn't tell us why. He records on another occasion that one of his daughters is able, as he says, to go it alone by herself. In other words, she's able to walk. Well, of course, I think all of his children were able to walk at some point, say within the first 12 or 15 months of their lives, but he only observes that of one of his children. What he's likely to observe is two kinds of things. When they're sick, that is the exceptional rather than the norm, and then when they have difficulty being nursed and when they are weaned. And it is the nursing and the weaning that is one of the most interesting aspects of the Parkman diary, because although we have nothing from the Mrs. Parkmans about the process of breastfeeding, we do have the father's notations about it. Certainly he notes if the mother has trouble in terms of the coming of her milk or in physical trouble in nursing the children. He notes if a child is ill and cannot nurse properly. He notes if his wife is ill and cannot nurse properly. And then when the child is to be weaned, for those children whose weaning takes place, if I can explain this properly, whose weaning takes place when the diary survives, that is, the children listed on that second page, he reports the time and the manner or the circumstances of the child's weaning. Several interesting things about this process. First of all, it's clearly an abrupt process. That is, there's no gradual accustoming of the child, at least in the diary, to any kind of nourishment other than its mother's milk. So the weaning is something that takes place abruptly, and it takes place by a total physical separation of mother and child. Typically, the mother goes away for a day or two and allows the child to be weaned and to be introduced to other sources of nourishment. On two occasions, the child is sent away. You grimaced at that. There are very good reasons for that. And first, let me preface that by saying the child, in both of those cases, is sent away either to another member of the family, in one case when there are two households, that is after the split between the two parishes, what now is now Northborough and Westborough. Parkman's house is located in an inconvenient place. He has to rebuild near the meeting house. He then ends up with two houses, one he lives in and t'other house, as he calls it in the diary. That's where his son Ebenezer goes and is married, begins to raise a family. So on one occasion, when the child is sent away, it's sent over to Ebenezer's house. On another occasion, one of the daughters takes it to a neighbor's house. The very good reason for sending the child away, in both cases, Mrs. Parkman was too ill to leave the house. So given the sort of rules of the weaning as it's apparent from the diary, the rules are absolute physical separation, abrupt weaning, separation of mother and child, with the mother leaving the household if she can. The child staying, of course, back in the familiar surroundings with people who are familiar to the child. There's another aspect of nursing and weaning that's, I think, very interesting, again, because breastfeeding is, while it's becoming more popular today, it's certainly not as universal as it was in the 17th or 18th century. An aspect of it is that children, insofar as I can tell from the Parkman diary in Westborough, were never wet-nursed in the sense that we usually use the term. For example, Samuel Sewall of Boston, a tremendously wealthy, prominent, powerful man, is able to afford the services of a wet nurse for his children, and his wives want those services. That is, they are not interested, apparently, in nursing their own children. Sewall, however, is the exception. The rule throughout New England is pervasively one that not only because you can't afford any other option do you nurse your children, but also because the culture says so, and there's some wonderful arguments on behalf of breastfeeding. Now, there is a kind of wet nursing that takes place in Westborough, and that's the kind of thing that what happens if you have to go out of town for a couple of days and you can't take your child with you? Well, give it to a neighbor or a friend or a relative who's nursing a child and go away for the day or two and then come back and resume nursing the child. That's one possibility. There's a marvelous scene when Elizabeth Harrington Parkman, Ebenezer's wife, young Ebenezer's wife, gives birth to a child, nurses it, and then falls sick and is unable to nurse the child. And so the child is sent over to Hannah Breck Parkman, that is the stepmother-in-law, if you can get this genealogy straight, who nurses not only her step-granddaughter, but her own child as well. And that causes some consternation, at least on Parkman's part, because he's not sure that physically she's able to do it. The other thing, and I've only seen two references to this in colonial documents, is the use of breast milk for nursing an adult as opposed to a child. One of the occasions on which a child is sent out of the household to be weaned is when Ebenezer, the minister, is so deathly ill that his wife has to devote all of her attention to nursing him literally into, or not literally, I'm not sure literally, but nursing him in two respects. That is, tending after himself, but also supplying him with breast milk, because that's apparently the only nourishment which he can take. Whether the weaning of children is a traumatic thing, I'm not sure. Parkman's certainly concerned about it because it's an important enough occasion for him to note it, and then it's important enough for him to say the child takes it tolerably well. In other words, there's a sense of anxiety, a sense of impending trouble. There apparently was no difficulty, but there was the possibility of difficulty, as he records it in his diary. As I've said, the Parkman children appear very seldom in the diary when they're 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years of age. Basically, I think that is because of the fact that they're too young to be productive members of the household. That is, they're too young to learn chores, they're too young to teach the alphabet, and so on. But gradually, sometimes as early as the age of 3 or 4, but certainly by the age of 5, 6, and 7, the children come into more focus and more regular focus, particularly the male children. For example, we find one reference in the diary to one of the children being sent home from school at age 3 because the schoolmaster thinks the child has broken its leg. Is the child learning his alphabet at school, or is school merely a place where the child can be looked after and kept out of the parents' hair? We find the boys learning